We so far have enrolled 250 registered from 51 countries.
So it is about personal best and inclusion.
It certainly is, yes.
I explained that there's a triathlon for gay men, tanning, brunch, and tea dance.
Her mild amusement, perhaps at my youth, turned to nervousness as I mentioned the L word in the title of Anita's book. You seem to be saying that I have to be led either by white women or black men. Why can't I lead myself?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. New Zealand's first out-of-the-closet MP goes into the cabinet. Differently abled athletes add to gay games diversity and enduring exhortations from black lesbian in white America. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Zindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 17th, 2002. Chris Carter, New Zealand's first openly gay member of parliament, will now be his nation's first openly gay cabinet member. After his election to the cabinet by the Labour Party's parliamentary caucus, Prime Minister Helen Clark named him her Minister for Conservation and Local Government. Carter told reporters, "I'd like to be defined by my efficiency, not my sexuality. I'm looking forward to representing the diversity of New Zealand."
Carter was first elected to Parliament from the Wellington area in 1993 and mentioned his gay orientation in his maiden speech. In 1996, he lost his seat by a very narrow margin after redistricting that left him running against two other sitting MPs. But he came roaring back in 1999 from Auckland's Te Atatu riding and again won that seat by a huge majority in the latest vote. Carter has campaigned for gay and lesbian civil rights for three decades, and he's a founder of his party's Rainbow Labour gay and lesbian group. In the parliament, he has been a vocal advocate for legal recognition of same-gender couples, helping to enact a law that took effect this year to give dissolving couples access to the courts for a division of property, and supporting a soon-to-be-introduced civil unions bill. Carter himself has been partnered for almost 30 years with Peter Kaiser, a primary school principal. Before entering politics, Carter was a teacher and a chicken farmer.
Carter's tenure in the cabinet will be no walk in the park. Although his Labour Party won more seats than any other in July's national elections, it lost about a quarter of the support that brought it to power in 1999 and must form a coalition government. Labour's seeking to partner with not only the Liberal Green Party, but also the United Future Party, which includes a number of Christian fundamentalists. Even while that coalition was being negotiated, some were predicting it wouldn't last a year, and the Dominion Post newspaper called this a toxic parliament. Carter wants to believe party leader Peter Dunne, who insists that United Future is a centrist moderate party. But one of its fundamentalist MPs, Paul Adams, has already shown otherwise. In the past, Adams opposed civil rights protections for gays and lesbians and urged quarantining people with HIV. Last week, he called for public identification of people with HIV, saying he wouldn't want to go into a room with any disease that was contagious and not be made aware of the possibilities of that contact. Transsexual Labour MP Georgina Beyer suggested it might be hard for her to work with UF's fundamentalists, while openly gay Labour MP Tim Barnett fears that what he called Adams' Neanderthal views might be representative of a sizable group within that party. Even a deputy leader of the right-wing Christian Heritage Party, Merapeka Rakawatate, sharply criticized Adams, saying his sentiments are inhumane and unchristian and he should be ashamed of himself. Voters can now be aware that by supporting United Future, they've in fact supported a dangerous group of Christian fundamentalists.
Also in New Zealand this week, the nation's largest gay and lesbian parade and festival, Auckland's Hero, appears to have ended forever. After years of financial struggles, the organizing group, the Hero Trust, has voted unanimously to close down. The last Hero Parade, held in March, was only about a quarter the size of its predecessors, which had attracted more than 100,000 spectators. Hero began as an AIDS charity fundraiser and for years generated substantial contributions to local groups.
And although 100,000 people were expected to visit Manchester, England in the coming week for a massive annual gay and lesbian Mardi Gras festival, the main street party has been canceled. After extensive negotiations with the event's organizers, an association of business owners in the city's gay village, the Greater Manchester Police refused to make an exception to local ordinances limiting use of alcohol in the streets. The Manchester City Council supports the police position, particularly since larger drinking areas were permitted for a World Cup party and a recent music festival. Pride organizers are accusing the city police of discrimination, which the force denies. There have been no problems since the festival was first held in 1993. A smaller-scale party will go on in the neighborhood's gay bars, and the Pride March will go on as planned.
London's gay and lesbian Mardi Gras lost £400,000 this year, but what's billed as Britain's biggest admission-free gay and lesbian festival, Brighton Pride, was a resounding success that attracted thousands of partiers. The Brighton Fest was staged for a total cost equal to about a quarter of London's losses. The funds came from community support and are believed to be more than offset by increased income for local businesses.
In other Pride news this week, Singapore saw its second Pride party as more than 2,500 people turned out in Sentosa for Nation, a gay and lesbian celebration of the country's independence. Dr. Stuart Koh, chief operating organizer of co-sponsor Friday.com, said that by repeating the event, we're making a statement. We're for real and we're here to stay. The government offered no resistance to the event, encouraging hope that its customary anti-gay stance is softening.
That's certainly not the case in South Korea, where a court this week reportedly upheld the government's censorship of a gay website. Xzone.com was the nation's first gay website until the government acted to block it and imposed a fine of $10,000. Last year, South Korea shut down or blocked more than 12,000 sites under its Internet Content Filtering Ordinance. But the Korean Information and Communications Ethics Committee specifically classified homosexuality and obscenity and perversion to make gay websites harmful media under the indecency criteria applied by the Ministry of Information and Communications. 15 gay groups joined to sue the government for its action against several gay websites. This week's ruling is the first judicial decision on the government's anti-gay internet censorship, and it upheld the government's action as legal and constitutional, although the full text of the court's finding has not yet been published.
But the British government continues to increase its recognition of gays and lesbians. At its behest, the Office for National Statistics has begun for the first time to ask about sexual orientation in its regular surveys. Civil servants require the data and budget planning to extend pensions and other benefits to same-gender couples in accord with the European directive. The head of the National Gay and Lesbian Group Stonewall, Angela Mason, said the count demonstrates that the position of lesbians and gay men in society is being taken far more seriously, but added that whether there are 5,000 or 5 million, it's wrong to treat people unfairly.
Meanwhile, Britain's Labour-dominated Parliament is revising its own rules to extend equal treatment to its unmarried members, including gay and lesbian MPs. The Speaker of the House has ordered a committee to devise a method to ensure that members' domestic partners will enjoy spousal travel benefits, which include free first-class travel by train or plane between London and their constituencies.
Same-gender couples also made a notable gain in New York City this week. After heated debate, the city council voted by a 5-1 margin to recognize visitors' certifications of gay and lesbian partnerships, civil unions, and legal marriages from other jurisdictions. Those couples will gain all the benefits of New York City's own partnership registry, which grants unmarried couples full equality with legal spouses in all matters under the city's control.
Australia's Senate will apparently have its first lesbian member, with the swearing-in this coming week of South Australia's Penny Wong. Although Wong has already been receiving considerable attention as the Senate's first woman of Asian descent, this week the Adelaide Advertiser newspaper said that, in Labour circles, it is also well known that Senator Wong is gay, a fact she would prefer to leave as a private matter. The Sydney Star-Observer, Australia's largest circulation gay and lesbian paper, did not obtain confirmation from Wong's office, but cited local sources in saying she has long been open about her sexuality. Wong's staff told the Star-Observer that at such time as she could arrange an interview, she would not discuss her personal life. Openly gay Senator Brian Gregg said Wong should have been allowed to decide for herself whether to come out.
And finally, in the U.S., a gay man and a lesbian both won a new level of recognition in their hometowns this week. San Francisco's Recreation and Parks Department approved naming a city gymnasium in honor of rugby enthusiast Mark Bingham, who's believed to have been a leader among the passengers who stopped the fourth airplane hijacked by terrorists on September 11th from reaching its intended target. A ceremony will be held soon to unveil a plaque honoring Bingham at the gym that's located in the city's heavily gay Castro district. Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Melissa Etheridge has long lived in Los Angeles, but this week she had quite a good reason to visit the scenes of her childhood. Leavenworth, Kansas, officially unveiled signs proclaiming itself her hometown. Mayor Larry Dedicus said that Etheridge's talent presents a new spotlight on her hometown, while admitting that Leavenworth is mostly known for the prisons.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 17th, 2002, written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
A cultural critic considers the lasting impact of a classic work of lesbian nonfiction, and lesbian humorist Kate Clinton shoots some hoops later in the program. There's more than one thing that sets the gay games apart from the Olympics and other supposedly straight world-class sporting events. Unlike even the Paralympics, which are treated more like poor relatives in the world of international athletic competition, participation of people with special needs and disabilities is fully integrated into the gay games. The Special Needs and Disabilities, or SND, outreach group of the 2002 Games, being held this November in Sydney, Australia, has been committed to maximizing inclusion of the differently abled. Our correspondent Uma Kali Shakti chats with Gay Games SND outreach group member Bill Rigney to find out more.
I've been involved for about 18 months, although the group itself has been meeting since before the bid to get the Games to Sydney.
Which is how long?
It's about 5 years. We got the we won the bid in 4 years ago, but we set up the S&D committee to show that in our bid we were going to ensure that it was possible for all people to participate in these games, as it has been in games four and five.
So it's in fact been very active for quite a long time. In fact, it's probably the oldest existing of the outreach groups within the gay games.
It probably is, yes, because there are a lot of, I'm just going through it tonight, how many things there are we have to consider for people with special needs and disabilities. And we've had to build on Amsterdam. Amsterdam set a good example, and we want to equal and or better their example.
When did you get involved, and what was the thing that powered you to get involved?
Well, I was involved with a group called Access Plus Spanning Identities. Now, I was a member of that for about 2.5 years. And on the committee there was a member from the Gay Games. And part of their policy was to get involved with groups like ours. And Access Plus was a group that tried to look after people with disabilities who are gay, lesbian, trannies or bisexual.
And it's quite a diverse group in itself, because people don't realise people with disabilities span all spectrums.
It's amazing how many different needs there are. For example, intellectual disability, hearing and vision, HIV/AIDS, medical conditions, mental illness, neurological disorder, brain injury, and physical disabilities. So I've had to look at access to venues, access to places in Sydney, and try and help those people enjoy the experience of the games as an able person would.
And I understand you've been very important in the whole audit process. Would you like to explain that?
Well, to ensure that people with disabilities or special needs enjoy and are comfortable at these games, we've had to go to each venue, both sporting and social, where we're going to have celebrations, the closing and the opening ceremonies, and ensure that people with the disabilities or special needs are properly catered for, i.e. wheelchair access, sign interpreters where necessary, which will be at the opening games, and games where it is necessary to have a signer.
The other thing is, of course, they're not only for people to come to watch, but for actually participants. Do you know anything about the participants that are coming?
Well, of the participants that we so far have enrolled, 250 registered, and from 51 countries, and they're going to be in most events.
Right, and there's 31 sports, and there's a huge cultural program, as well as the 7 conferences.
That's right, and a lot of people are interested in the conferences.
Do you know what kind of sports or cultures or conferences any of the people are going to be involved in?
Well, particularly the conferences seem to have attracted quite a few people, but then there are the events where wheelchairs, basketball, etc., people are contestants in those.
One of the interesting things, unlike the Olympic Games, where you had the Paralympics and the Commonwealth Games, that actually in these games, our games, people with disabilities will be competing with anybody else.
That's correct.
Able-bodied and disabled people together.
Yes. Yes, and there was a special process of working out how that could happen. So we've gone through many different steps to ensure that everybody can participate in these games.
So it is about personal best and inclusion.
It certainly is, yes.
That was Umar Kali Shakti talking to Bill Rigney of the Special Needs and Disabilities Outreach Group of the 2002 Sydney Gay Games. There is more information at the Gay Games website, www.sydney2002.org.au. That's www.sydney2002.org.au.
Before I came out to my dad, I told him that I was going to the G-Games and tried to slur my way through it.
Lesbian feminist humorist Kate Clinton from her 1999 audiobook, Don't Get Me Started.
By the time the games were held in New York City, I was out to my dad, and when I told him I was going, even though we were on the phone, I could hear him think, the gay games? What in God's name are the events? I explained that there's a triathlon for gay men, tanning, brunch, and tea dance. The sperm carry, an event for women that involves small artichoke jars and running from burrow to burrow. The medal is awarded based on number and motility of sperm at the end of the day. He told me to cut it out. While I'm no fabulous sports babe, one of my career goals, besides writing comedy that all people can dance to, is to be a sportscaster. Bo might know baseball, but I know a couple of things as well. My high school girls' basketball team was unheralded and undefeated. It was the years of the three-dribble rule in girls' basketball. After 3 dribbles, a player had to pass the ball. Most of the girls on my team had learned to play basketball with their brothers and could give dribbling clinics at halftime, so the 3-dribble rule made the game slow, a Valium invitational. Only 2 players on each team were allowed to run the full length of the court, or were thought even to be able to do it. They were called the Rovers, or lesbians. Non-rovers skidded black skid marks to a halt at the mid-court line. Since I had learned to play with my brothers on our long, narrow driveway, I had a great outside shot and was good under the basket. Although I didn't think so, others, especially referees, thought I played too rough. My coach sent me in for hatchet jobs, and I usually fouled out before the game was over. Nothing helps pass the time better in a long northeast winter than watching women's basketball. Now we can watch it year-round thanks to the new women's pro leagues. The WNBA games are much more fun to watch in person, though. The televised games seem to be produced by the same people who covered the 1989 San Francisco earthquake and managed never to mention the words gay or lesbian. The WNBA games studiously avoid any long, loving pans of the celebrity row lest they inadvertently out someone as a basketball fan. In a roiling sea of short-haired women fans, they focus on the one dozing father and his bored-looking son. Sometimes, after a fabulous, I love this game play of the week, they mistakenly flash on a bevy of square-bottomed lesbians high-fiving in the stand, and it's quick, camera 2, back to Cheryl Miller's hair weave. I'm Kate Clinton, and an informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
If you see me stumble,
Anita Cornwell was the first writer to identify as a black lesbian in print. Her Black Lesbian in White America, published by NIAID Press in 1983, launched a heated debate that has never really been resolved. This Way Out's Janet Mason reflects on her friendship with the pioneering writer and discusses why Cornwell's vibrant message still resonates today.
I first met Anita Cornwell in the early 80s at a reading that she and Becky Bertha were giving at a now-defunct lesbian and gay community center located on Camac Street, one of the back alleys of Center City, Philadelphia. Anita was reading from her book, Black Lesbian in White America, published in 1983, the same year that I came out as a lesbian. The room where Anita and Becky, whose book, For Nights Like This One, had just been published, read, was small and cramped and filled with lesbians. There was no place in the world I would have preferred to be. Many of the women in the room, Anita and Becky included, would come to be important members of my community, intimate friends, and fellow travelers in a life that still lay ahead of me. At their time, their faces were still new to me, and these women I had yet to meet, like my list of books I had yet to read, were an endless source of fascination for me. Looking back on this reading by these two women who were to become influential friends and alter my course as a lesbian writer, I'd like to say that my world split open, that I was shaken to the core, my perspective inalterably changed. But this reading was almost 20 years ago, and, as memory goes, there are many things that have slipped away from me. I do know that this reading was an important part of my ongoing consciousness raising, which in those days seemed to be a daily, if not hourly, event. Since I can't recall who I was with, I assume I went alone, but I didn't feel alone in the intimacy of that small room which resounded with the leveling honesty of both Anita and Becky's work. When the authors had finished reading, I went up to the front of the room and sat down with them. I remember that we talked for a while, and that what we talked about, perhaps, was substantial, since less than a year later I ended up in the same writing group with them. But all I recall of our conversation is that I wore purple day-glow socks, and that the aspect of my personality that was reflected in this was not lost on Anita. Perhaps it was those purple socks that set the stage for a friendship. I read both of their books and wrote a review of Black Lesbian in White America for Telewoman, the newsletter of the Women's Switchboard, a collective of which I had been a member, and also published a review in Off Our Backs, the lesbian feminist newspaper out of Washington, D.C. Anita's book was fire under my heels. Shortly after reading and reviewing it, I attended a women's liberation conference at Temple University. No doubt many powerful things were said at this conference, but what I remember most was that one of the women on the panel, a white heterosexual upper-middle-class woman who had made a name for herself in the feminist movement, answered a question from the audience by saying something to the extent that the women's movement wanted to include black women, but that those women didn't want to join us. The audience was a very mixed group, black and white women and other races, representing members of the local community as well as students and the academics who worked at the university. Hisses and objections to this obviously racist remark rifled through the audience, my own voice among the chorus. After the speakers were done, the room was still buzzing with lively dialogue and debate. I entered into a conversation with a conservatively dressed black woman a few decades older than me, who had previously been talking to one of the few men in the room. Her mild amusement, perhaps at my youth, or my idealism, or my red high-top sneakers, turned to nervousness as I mentioned the L-word in the title of Anita's book. Then I paraphrased Anita's statement. You seem to be saying that I have to be led either by white women or black men. Why can't I lead myself? That's right, the woman explained, her vehemence and enthusiasm undampened by the fact that her male companion was still standing by her side. Her consciousness changed on a dime, and that is the power of the written word. Anita came of age as a lesbian in the 1950s, and in her early writings, published in The Ladder and The Negro Digest, she was among the first, if not the first, to identify as a black lesbian in print. Born in the Deep South, when integration was a term seen only in the dictionary, Anita writes of herself as a young woman hanging out in the village where she was looking for some of them, but they were home in the closet growing shoe trees. She writes of her involvement in the women's movement when she was often one of the oldest women in the room, as well as being one of the few black women. We of the 50s and the 40s and on back to when not only had to operate from the closet, but worse yet, most of us seemed to exist in a vacuum. Anita's writing reminds us of the things that were and are specific to her generation, and at the same time she writes of truisms that we would do well to heed today. Just as is there is no such thing as a little bit of pregnancy, ditto with oppression, she writes. And she reminds us that with all the freedom of expression allowed today, Hollywood's exploitation of women is more violent and vicious than even the most pessimistic feminist would have believed possible just 15 years ago. And she stares truth in the face baldly by questioning the obvious. Out of over 50 million women in this country, why are so many content to be little more than charwomen for men? Anita Cornwell writes in a voice that is incisive. As Becky Bertha writes in the foreword of the book, Anita puts forth an acute political analysis of both racial and sexual oppressions, both radical and feminist, written long before those words were in common use together. She writes of her collective struggles, joining her voice in the long interview in the midsection of the book with that of Audre Lorde's. And she writes of her individual struggles as a lesbian writer. After staring at hundreds of blank pages, I learned to face myself. I learned that I not only existed, but that I had every right to my own existence. As strong as this voice is, it is my concern that it continues to be heard. Books go out of print, and politics, though they are still as necessary as ever, go out of fashion. History becomes yet another memory that slides away. I would like this not to happen with Anita. Anita writes in a voice that is above all else unapologetically her own, a voice that is capable of reminding generations to come that they have every right to their own existence. With commentary on Anita Cornwell and her book, Black Lesbian in White America, from Naiad Press, and with thanks to Deborah D'Alessandro for production assistance, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Rex Walkner, Uma Kali Shakti, and Janet Mason contributed program material. Thanks also to Michael Schembri and Deborah D'Alessandro. Sweet Honey in the Rock performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Arcus Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Access Radio Wellington, New Zealand, KRUX Las Cruces, New Mexico, WEOS Geneva, New York, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please stay tuned.